Hello, this is Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Today, a story about veterans finding their place on the farm. We'll also hear from Harvest about why scientists can't seem to agree on whether or not the active ingredient in Roundup causes cancer. For our food today, Chef Daniel Orr shows us how to make winter greens delicious. And Gordon Edgar makes his living working with fancy cheeses, but he appreciates a bright orange artificial cheese-like product from time to time.
I always say, don't hate on Velveeta for being Velveeta. It's more of a reflection of our food system than it's the problem itself.
From Velveeta to vegan cheese to why cheddar gets no respect. But first, of course, we start with food and farming news. From the election, here's Mark Chilla.
That's right, Annie. Lots of big election stories this week. We had an eye on Massachusetts, where voters answered yes to question 3, which prohibits the sale of foods from animals raised in small cages. Large-scale farms often raise animals in confinements, in which they are unable to move before they're slaughtered. The question 3 referendum says animal products sold in Massachusetts can still be raised in confinements, but that those confinements must be large enough for an animal to stand, turn around, or, in the case of hens, spread its wings. Of chief concern among opponents is the potential for the rising cost of food. Groups like Citizens Against Food Injustice say the cost of question 3 is too high for consumers and will disproportionately affect low-income communities. A Boston Globe analysis shows question 3 will cost consumers, but only between 1 and 5 cents more per egg. California passed an almost identical measure in 2008, with nearly two-thirds of the state vote. Voters in 3 cities in California passed ballot measures to place a 1 cent per ounce tax on sodas and other sugar-sweetened beverages, a move aimed at tackling obesity. In San Francisco, 62% of voters cast their ballots in favor of the tax on sugary drinks. Similar measures passed in Oakland and Albany, California. Additionally, Boulder, Colorado passed a 2 cents per ounce tax. After Berkeley, California passed a tax on sugary drinks, one study found that consumption of sugary drinks dropped by about 20%. And after Mexico imposed a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages in 2014, researchers documented a decline in sales. The CEO of the American Heart Association touted the passage of the soda tax measures as a big win for public health. The American Beverage Association, which represents all the big soda brands, led the effort to oppose the soda tax measures. The group spent upwards of $9.5 million on an ad campaign dubbed "Don't Tax Our Groceries." Another story about food taxes from the week, a study published in the journal Nature Climate Change found that taxing beef at 40% and milk at 20% would pay for the damage their production causes the Earth's climate. Food production generates one quarter of total greenhouse gas emissions, according to The Guardian, and those numbers are increasing globally. The tax plan would reduce beef production emissions by 600 million tons per year and dairy production emissions by 200 million tons. The study bases the tax for each product on the amount of money required to compensate for the climate damage caused by its production, taking into account feed, waste, and global transportation. It found the taxes needed to compensate for climate damage were 7% on pork and 5% on eggs. Vegetable oil required a large tax of 25%, but because of the low initial price of the product, the overall cost remains affordable. Researchers say another goal is similar to that of soda taxes. Higher beef and dairy taxes would deter people from purchasing and ultimately consuming the product, positively impacting their health in the long run. And then this story. United Nations agencies estimate up to 1.4 million Haitians need food help after Hurricane Matthew struck in mid-October, with 800,000 of those in dire need. The Category 4 storm devastated fields, fruit orchards, and food stocks, and wiped out fishing operations in the worst-hit areas. With existing local produce quickly running out, the Food and Agriculture Organization has appealed for more funding. The group estimates an additional $56 million is needed to stave off famine over the next 3 months. The 2016 Global Hunger Index said that even before Matthew's destruction, more than half of Haiti's 10 million people were undernourished. Thanks to Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killo for these stories. You can read more about it on our website, and then when you share it on Twitter or Facebook, be sure to tag us. We're at Earth Eats.
Great, Mark. Thanks for the news.
My pleasure.
Scientists are having a hard time agreeing whether the weed killer used most commonly in the U.S. can cause cancer. The chemical is glyphosate, known by the brand name Roundup. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach explains why scientists disagree about the health risk posed by the blockbuster herbicide.
If you don't know glyphosate, you should know it's sprayed on farm fields across the country.
Especially in Midwest, where our cropping system is corn and soybean.
Amit Jala is a weed scientist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He says almost all the corn and soybeans grown here are genetically modified to resist glyphosate, so it only kills the weeds. There's also resistant alfalfa, sugar beets, and cotton.
So yeah, that's true. Right now, glyphosate is number one herbicide in Nebraska and also in several other states in the Midwest.
Glyphosate is not just in farm fields, though. It's in my garage. People use it on their lawns and gardens. I got this little spray bottle of Roundup at the garden store to take care of crabgrass in my flower beds, dandelions in the driveway, things like that. Glyphosate is like any pesticide. You don't let the kids handle it, you don't drink it, no one argues with that. The question is, if you use it according to the label, can it cause cancer? Recently, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency tackled that very question.
And they came to the conclusion that they have, again and again, that glyphosate should be classified as not likely to be a carcinogen to humans.
That's Donna Farmer, a toxicologist with Monsanto, the company that discovered glyphosate as a herbicide in the 1970s. Clearly, Farmer has an interest here, but she's right. The EPA reviewed dozens of glyphosate studies and decided that it is not likely to cause cancer at the doses most people probably experience.
And they are consistently coming out with the same findings that the Canadian government did, the European Union did, the Japan government did.
New Zealand and Australia too, she says. Regulators from the U.S. and all those other countries agree glyphosate is not likely to cause cancer. But last year, another group of scientists reached a different conclusion. IARC, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, called glyphosate a probable carcinogen. Aaron Blair is the epidemiologist who chaired the IARC panel, which is part of the World Health Organization. Blair calls the difference between IARC and EPA a contradiction in flavor.
Not likely to be a carcinogen means, of course, we think this is not likely to be a carcinogen. But, well, you know, maybe. So both of those evaluations, the EPA and the IARC, have an element of probability in them.
But why are they so far apart? It's largely a difference in design. IARC simply wants to know if cancer is possible, even at very high experimental doses. The EPA puts more emphasis on studies that evaluate the risk in real-world situations. That makes a difference. Also, IARC only looks at studies published in scientific journals. The idea is to avoid conflicts of interest. But Donna Farmer says it leaves out industry research conducted by Monsanto according to EPA guidelines.
All of the other agencies looked at all of the data. And again, I will tell you, IARC, in my opinion, by the way that they evaluated the data, created a hazard that no one else has identified.
IARC has given cancer ratings that raise eyebrows. The insecticide malathion is a probable carcinogen, like glyphosate, but so are red meat and wood smoke and hot drinks. Aaron Blair from the IARC Review says the point is to show scientists and regulators where more research is needed.
You would like to have a very clear determination the minute you look at things, but that rarely happens.
The EPA does want more research on glyphosate, particularly on different formulations, that is, different chemicals mixed in to make the herbicide more effective. They want to know if the combination has an effect that the chemicals don't have on their own. Aaron Blair says the riskiest exposure to glyphosate comes when people spray the chemical and get it on their skin. So simple precautions like wearing gloves and goggles and cleaning up are worthwhile, whether or not it's likely to cause cancer. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Another story from Harvest. For many veterans, returning home from war is a tough transition. Some can find a new sense of purpose in the field, tending to vegetables or livestock. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon has this profile of one couple who decided to try farming after spending years in war zones.
Ben and Letitia Ward's farm in Fountain, Colorado, outside Colorado Springs, doesn't look like an army base or anything. But you quickly start to uncover whiffs of military influence. Take this stack of sturdy fiberglass bins next to a greenhouse.
Case in point, these are the shipping cases for JDAMs.
What's that?
JDAM is a joint directed smart bomb.
Shipping smart bombs. Ward picks up the decommissioned boxes from military surplus sales. He then outfits them as brooding bins for chickens and is using them to design an aquaponic system to grow veggies and fish at the same time.
It was purged courtesy of the U.S. Army. Thank you, U.S. Army. Now it's a fish tank.
The couple's farm, with hoop houses, small sheds, and livestock pens, is built on a foundation of decommissioned military gear, found materials, and old barns.
And it does give us a huge advantage because we can do things cheaper because he doesn't need to go buy something just to do an aquaponic setup.
The couple grew up in Oregon. They met in high school. And because both had family members who'd joined the military, decided to enlist as well. Out of college, the two were stationed at Fort Carson, within earshot of the couple's farm now. While we're chatting, a faint pitter-patter of gunfire off in the distance interrupts us.
What is that gun? Is that a shooting range?
That's Carson.
That's Fort Carson.
Oh, you can hear it from here.
Oh, yeah. Depending on the atmospheric conditions, we can hear everything. And having a background in that, we can know that that's a, you know, M4, M16 range.
After deployments as Army logisticians in Iraq and Afghanistan, Ben and Letitia wanted to start a family and leave the base behind. Neither grew up on farms, but found themselves drawn to the calmer pace. Plus, the complex nature of farming allows them to draw on the problem-solving skills instilled in them by their military training.
A farm is really just one big logistical problem where you are balancing all of the different requirements versus outputs.
When Ben was in Iraq, his role was to make sure every time a tank would leave the base that it had all the supplies for its trip. Fuel, food, water, ammo. He was constantly preparing. What will the needs be? What's my contingency plan? He's in that exact same mindset on the farm.
I'm forecasting, you know, water usage, what needs to get harvested first versus last, maintenance on the equipment. There's a lot of similarities in that respect.
You can see it in how the farm runs. They grow leafy greens and root vegetables. They raise chickens, ducks, sheep, quail, and turkeys. That diversity is meant to cushion the farm from unforeseen hardships. Like this year, a grasshopper swarm decimated their salad greens, but they were able to blunt the impact by selling eggs and wool.
And that kind of risk management, I think, is really an offshoot of our military conditioning, is that you always have a backup plan.
While they're no longer on active duty, the two haven't fully left their military life behind. They're still in the Army Reserves, another source of income while their two-year-old farm gains its footing. And that means they're often switching between the Army base and the farm.
It's a lot less stressful. We have our stress, but on the whole, it's a lot less stressful than conducting logistics in a deployed environment. Which is one of our goals getting into this, is finding peace, I guess you could say. I don't know. And it has had an effect. We're generally more relaxed than we used to be.
And that's why Ben says when he's selling at the local farmers market, he spends a lot of time doling out advice to other veterans, advice on how they could start their own farms. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
these stories at harvestpublicmedia.org, and hope you'll find them on Twitter, too. They are at HarvestPM. Coming up next, how do you cook spinach? Two different ideas using two different kitchen tools. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb, taste matters, your taste. Current truck location available at whereisurgent.com. I'm Annie Corrigan. Hi there. Daniel went to the farmer's market recently and cleaned up. Yes, even in November, there's still plenty of beautiful produce coming out of southern Indiana.
Today we've got a really nice selection. You can see how colorful it is. They're full of nutrients. You can just see how vibrant they are. They store well. What I do is I take them home, I wrap them with a little bit of wet paper towel, put them in an open plastic bag in the refrigerator, and they'll keep for another couple weeks. So we've got some radicchio here. This is escarole, which is one of my favorites. It's got kind of these dark leaves on the outside and then this really nice, almost like a sunburst yellow on the inside. We've got some frisée, which is kind of a curly endive. And then we've got some collard greens. This is a good old substantial southern green. A lot of times when people have something like a collard green like this, they cook it for 2 or 3 hours with a big knob of pork shank or something like that. And those are delicious, but there's no reason why you can't also do it more in a Brazilian way, where you slice it really, really thin, quick saute with some garlic and ginger, and serve it with orange slices. I've got collard greens even into January in my garden that are still kind of struggling by, and we can go by and pick a few of those. I've got some of this nice curly kale. You can also get different colored kales. You can get the different orange and vibrant colored kales that a lot of times people use for decoration, but they're good to eat as well. And then we have all the different cabbages. You have red cabbage, green cabbage, Savoy cabbage, Napa cabbage, and even these little guys, which are Brussels sprouts, which are also a member of the cabbage family. Like I did say, they are much stronger in flavor than, let's say, oak leaf lettuce. So if you're going to use them in a salad, a lot of times you'll use a combination of flavors, such as a lot of times bacon is great in it with a little bit of honey. So you have the sweet, the smoky, the rich fattiness. Another thing a lot of people use on these kind of greens is different nut oils. So you have walnut oil or pistachio oil or pumpkin seed oil. All those things go really well with these types of greens.
From this show and tell, he picked out maybe the most normal green of the lot, spinach. He's cooked it in a bunch of really interesting ways in the past. Well, this demonstration today is not so interesting. It's more of a back-to-basics sort of recipe. Cooked spinach can be watery and lifeless, but it doesn't have to be if you have a microwave and a broiler. Daniel's going to do a little cooking comparison for us. He starts with salt, but not too much.
Same thing with the pepper, because it looks like a lot of spinach, but you'll see once we cook it. All right, so here we go. I'm going to put this in for about 3 minutes in a industrial microwave, probably about 4 to 5 minutes in a home microwave. And then follow me over here. We'll put this up under the broiler. Now you can use this broiler method with mushrooms as well. And you'll see it's going to wilt down very, very quickly, and it intensifies the flavor without getting it watery.
Spinach has vitamin A, B, and D, but spinach never appealed to me. But one day while having dinner with a guy, I decided to give it a try.
And it's getting juicy, too, so I guess that's its natural juices coming
that's
out.
It. It's a natural liquid without it kind of cooking in its juice. And for me, that's about the way that I like it. It has a little more of a bite. It's kind of like a warm salad. And it will continue to cook a little bit after we pull it out of the broiler. And we'll just serve that with a little lemon on the side, or lime, or Meyer's lemon. Okay, and there's our microwave. 3 minutes.
that's definitely a little more wilted.
A little more wilted. We could probably put it in there a little bit less time. But that's also perfect. You see, there's no liquid coming out of either one of those. You're going to have a really nice, intense flavor. We could put a little bit of Parmesan on top. And you could add other seasonings. You could add garlic. You could add lemon zest. You know, a little, instead of the olive oil, you could use a little bacon fat or a little bit of butter.
It's a good way to describe the one that you put in the broiler, a warm salad, because that's really what it feels like in my mouth.
And that would be nice, kind of sprinkled with some smoked trout. We used to do a salad like that served with sliced veal. And during the Christmas season, I did wilted spinach like that with a little truffle oil that I served with our roast beef.
I didn't like it the first time.
Plenty of ideas there to experiment with, but definitely don't forget the lemon. It makes such a huge difference in the taste of the spinach, trust me.
How it grew on me.
Okay, let's get a little fancier with the spinach. Here's a way to make some Thai-flavored greens.
We've got some soy sauce, a couple teaspoons of fish sauce, about a teaspoon of toasted sesame oil. And you can get those really in any big supermarket, but definitely at any ethnic market. They're kind of your secret arsenal. Add them to any of your dishes, and all of a sudden they start to taste a little more exotic. Basically, fish sauce is anchovies, fresh anchovies that are dried, and then they're covered with water and in barrels, and then left in the sun for about a year.
Doesn't that sound tasty, folks?
And it does smell strong, but it tastes great. And if you like Thai food, Vietnamese food, there's usually a little bit of fish sauce in those dressings. The sesame oil is made with white sesame seeds that are toasted and then pressed, so you get a toasted sesame flavor. So that's how that's made. About 2 tablespoons of sesame seeds. We're going to add some scallions. I'd say about three or four scallions. Okay, and then finally I'm going to add some ginger. Probably add about a teaspoon and a half. I'm cutting the ginger across the grain.
And you're not taking time to peel it.
No, when the ginger is young and the skin is smooth, you don't really need to peel it. Now, this is a dish you don't want to add like a citrus or lemon juice to it because it's going to discolor your spinach. You could always add a little bit at the end if you wanted to, but I don't think it's really necessary. Okay, we're going to toss our spinach in this.
That's what you're looking for?
Yeah, delicious.
To citrus or not to citrus? Let us know what you prefer with this one. Our email is eartheats@gmail.com. Gordon Edgar spends his days slinging cheese at the Rainbow Grocery Cooperative in San Francisco. One thing he's noticed from customers over his 20-plus years as a cheesemonger.
You know, when they started getting into fancy cheeses, they didn't want to talk about cheddar. It was almost like beneath them.
Because to American consumers, cheddar also means Kraft Singles and Velveeta. But cheddar started on the farm, small scale, made from milk from your personal herd of cows. In his new book, Edgar tracks the path of cheddar from the farm to the factory. His story starts in the mid-1800s on the American farm. Back then, cheesemaking was a way of extending the life of milk.
With cheddar, you're taking the curds that you create. You know, you add rennet, you get curds and whey, separate out the whey. And those curds, you just keep cutting them down, heating them up, stacking them on top of each other so that you get the most moisture out as possible. And that's what makes the cheese last a long time.
That stacking of the curds, that's called cheddaring. Then press it into cylindrical forms, wrap it in cheesecloth, and seal it with lard. Then comes the naturally occurring mold and bacteria as the cheese ages. Edgar says during this process, a lot of things can go wrong.
If you read the old, scientific magazines and newsletters and things like that, there's a lot of talk about cheeses just blowing up. There's a lot of talk about, getting maggots in your cheese. There's a lot of talk about, rinds cracking and cheese being inedible. And a lot of the technical aspects of cheddar making, which came in mostly the 1850s through the late 1800s, were about fixing those problems and making it so you could make a really aged cheese.
An Englishman, Joseph Harding, standardized cheese making. He developed a tool to mill the curds, and he also stressed safety. His method made its way across the Atlantic, where cheese factories in America in the early 1900s prided themselves on safety and homogeneity. They produced rindless cheddars that were coated in wax. Then Joseph Kraft came along and took the Swiss method of processing cheese, and he ran with it. You take a cheddar, heated and emulsified, and form it into a homogeneous plastic mass. That's one branch of the cheese family tree. A different branch is made up of companies like Tillamook. They've been making cheese in Oregon since the mid-1800s. These days, their factories produce 14 different types of cheddars that have been aged for different amounts of time. Total daily output, 167,000 pounds of cheese. Factory-produced cheese like this basically all starts with the same recipe, says Edgar, and it's the same recipe that cheesemakers have used for generations. He says the difference is in the execution.
I think a great way to look at this is there's a cheddar that is made by Cabot that is aged at the cellars of Jasper Hill, and it's a cloth-bound cheddar, which means it's traditionally made. It's aged in cheese cloth, larded, rotated. It's a cheese that can't age as long as a cheddar that's aged in plastic, but has much more character and flavor. And the ones that they make under the Jasper Hill aging name come from one specific farm. Like, that milk comes from one specific herd of cows. So it has a very distinctive taste. Now, Cabot also makes, pretty much using the exact same recipe, makes another cheese that they call Lamberton, that uses basically whatever milk that they have, you know, that day. The other difference is that it's not a traditional cheddar. It's aged in plastic. It doesn't have a rind. But often when I'm doing cheese events, I'll bring both those cheeses together and have people taste them. And it's amazing what difference you can taste.
Edgar does a lot of tasting in his line of work. He tends to focus on the Cabots and the Tillamooks of the world. But most co-ops like his offer a type of cheese that's more suited to the Kraft branch of the cheddar family tree.
In the past, you know, the vegan cheeses were always just kind of copying Kraft singles, basically. They were trying to make a plasticized, emulsified, processed, fake cheese, basically. And so, you know, you had the results you'd expect with that, which is that it didn't taste very good, you know. But now people are actually making something that has integrity as food. I mean, basically, people are taking nuts or taking cashews usually and fermenting them and actually doing something cheese-like with them, which is fermentation. But I think it's a mistake to call it cheese.
Whatever you want to call it, it's fairly easy to make at home. We've got several vegan fake cheese recipes on our website. Gordon Edgar's new book is Cheddar, A Journey to the Heart of America's Most Iconic Cheese. You can visit his website at gordonzola.net. That's Gordon, his first name, and Z-O-L-A. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible. It's Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets, from gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. And from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And we're out. I'm Annie Corrigan.